from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The black migration from the southern states in the United States represents an epic shift that had a lasting effect on America. Now, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalism professor Isabel Wilkerson takes on the ambitious task of chronicling the migration and many of the rich and tragic and dramatic human stories. Her book is called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. And she joins us for an hour, which will include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Who set you flowing? The black poet Gene Toomer asked in his 1923 masterpiece, Cain. He was writing about the many thousands of blacks who left the warmer climates of the South and headed north or west in search of a job, a better life. And all that has come to be known as the Great Migration. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson chronicles the exodus of some 6 million between 1915 and 1970. The first black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in journalism and the first to win for individual reporting. She's also a recipient of the coveted George Polk Award and John Guggenheim Fellowship and has lectured at Harvard and served as professor at Princeton and Emory and is currently professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. Her book is The Warmth of Other Suns. Some of you may recognize that title from Richard Wright. It's the epic story, the subtitle, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. She joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour, and welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. I should mention to listeners that your Pulitzer Prize, 1994, you were Chicago bureau chief of the New York Times. That was about the floods and a 10-year-old boy.
Yes. It was for yet another epic story that was in some ways a 500-year flood that also displaced people. So there's interesting connections between it. I hadn't even thought of it until you said that.
Well, it's great to get you thinking of those dots connecting. Certainly a lot of displacement here. And actually, we established the fact before we went on the air that you spent 15 years on this book, roughly 1,500 interviews?
1,200. I stopped counting after 1,200.
So may have been 1,500.
It could have been.
There seems to be kind of a commonality in many respects of people, I mean, as I said, coming up here because the jobs were up here, presumably, but also getting a sense of escaping from Jim Crow, escaping from the oppression and bigotry that was part of the Deep South, and sometimes finding the fruition of ambition up here, but more often, in many cases, finding different kinds of bigotry.
Well, after spending time talking to so many people and researching this, I've come to the conclusion that it was as much a defection from the South as it was a migration. In some ways, they were seeking political asylum in other parts of their own country to escape the caste system that had held them in a rigid place in which virtually every aspect of their daily lives and movements were dictated by laws that people set down in such arcane ways. I mean, for example, it was against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. And in many Southern courtrooms, there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on.
Well, I mentioned Richard Wright, and in Uncle Tom's Children, he writes about what he calls the ethic of living Jim Crow. You weren't supposed to read certain books. You weren't supposed to look at white women in any way at all. And there were all of these sort of unwritten laws that people had to subscribe to. And the idea was up north, you didn't have to live that way.
Yeah, the idea was that once they left, they would be no longer part of that caste system, at least in their view. And in some ways, they left for the same reason that any immigrant from any part of the world, the people who crossed the Atlantic in steerage, the people who've crossed the Pacific to get to these shores, in some ways, it was that immigrant longing and desire, the heart's desire to be free and to be able to build a new life in a place that there were no guarantees, but there was this hope and faith that life would be better. And so I see this as a way of looking and connecting the dots about how we all have this kind of this past. We're all here, really, because someone made the difficult choice to leave the only place that they'd ever known for a place they'd never seen. And I think that shows that we have so much more in common than we've been led to believe.
Well, that's sort of elemental American experience. In fact, you say they were more like refugees than migrants, so it becomes a diaspora of immigration like the American experience itself. And again, reminds me of Richard Wright, who said the Negro is America's metaphor.
Exactly.
Here we are.
Yeah. It was so massive that at the beginning of the century, the beginning of the Great Migration, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, decades later, nearly half were living outside of the South, in the North, in the Midwest, in the West. So it was a complete dispersal of an entire population of people in this country within the borders
of our
country.
It's not an understatement to say that it transformed America.
It transformed America on multiple levels, culturally, politically, economically. You might say it was in some ways a transfer of Southern culture from the South to other parts of the North and West, which then, once the people were exposed to the metabolism of the North, changed both North and South. The migration was also a precursor to the civil rights movement, because the people who left, their leaving was a proof that they were willing to, that they had options finally that came from World War I, and that they were willing to act on them. And that the people, once they got to the North, they were in a position to be in some ways a leverage for the people who stayed. So that the people who stayed were more in a position to face those hoses and the sheriff's dogs and the dangers that they faced when they tried to go toward the ultimate showdown, you might say, in the South. And then finally, because there were people in the North who were making more money than those in the South, they were, as with most immigrants, sending money back to the South to, you know, help their families and ultimately to finance this great migration. So it was an inspiration in some ways, both North and South.
Also coming back sometimes with flashy cars and a lot of cash in their pocket.
Absolutely.
And fine clothes and... That was a lure, too. Why? I mean, this is such an extraordinarily important historical story that has had so little attention.
I think that because, you know, thinking about when it began during World War I, and it began because the North needed workers, because the immigration from Europe had come to a halt, and there needed to be labor for the foundries, the steel mills, the slaughterhouses of the North, the factories of the North, and so the North began looking to the South for the cheap labor. It was in some ways the emerging market of the United States at that time. The South was the cheapest labor in the country were those who were African Americans, who were essentially not even accustomed of being paid, many of them, because they were essentially working for the right to live on someone else's land.
Or sharecroppers.
Sharecroppers, yeah. Correct. So that meant that, that's how it began. So it began during World War I. And with each stage and phase of the migration, people thought it was over. But no one told the people, so they continued to come. So it was hard to get a sense of what was this about and how long was it going to go on, what was the meaning of it. And the earliest reporters on this subject were not going to be there at the end of it. I mean, it started in 1915, it ended in 1970. One of our best-known poets was a reporter at the time that the migration began. A lot of people don't know that. And he wrote about it. It was Carl Sandburg. He was a reporter in Chicago. He was one of the first people to write about the migration. But, of course, by the time it was over, he was no longer around to be able to to tell that story. So
some of those hog butchers of the world were actually black people who came from the South.
Exactly. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
And 1917 was what was known as Red Summer. That was a spate of lynchings throughout the South, which also drove this engine that you're talking about of so many coming north.
Yeah, it was that violence that was necessary to maintain this untenable caste system, which was bound to unravel at some point. It just simply could not be maintained. If a system of that level of brutality and specificity is to be maintained, if it takes that kind of violence, then it means that eventually it was not going to last. And ultimately, the people began to, you might say, protest by walking away.
Talking with Isabel Wilkerson. Her book is The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, and she'll be appearing at St. Paul's Episcopal in Oakland this evening at 7:30 p.m. There's a sense in reading your book of certain things that you've discovered through your assiduous research, and I'm talking about things that may have been misconceptions but sociologically come to the fore here, and those have to do with, well, more black tied to their families and more educated than had been assumed, more education among blacks than had been assumed, and also the sense of much stronger ambitions than had been assumed.
I think that, you know, new research is coming out. Actually, it's now a burgeoning source of study, which is a wonderful thing to see, because now more census data is coming out. As each old census, 1930, 1940, becomes available and people are able to look at it with the new digitized technology that we now have, we're learning more and more about why these people left and what were the circumstances and that they had, what was the level of education. And it turns out that there is something special about people who are going to leave the only place they've ever known for a place far away. They end up often being greater risk takers. They're less patient for the status quo of wherever they happen to be. They tend to be better educated than those that they leave behind, and often are as educated, if not in some cases, some cities, they were more educated than the people who were there in the place that they arrived. The difference was that they culturally, they spoke, you know, with an accent, and they were not dressed in the same way as the sophisticated city people. So they stood out in that way, and they are often the source of a great deal of resentment, partly because there was a fear that they were going to threaten the wages of the people who were already there. In other words, the arrival of people
just like immigrants now.
Exactly, yeah. Just like immigrants now. So that's why I see these connections between the two. But some of the interesting facts that have come out as a result of the new analysis of census data, for which I'm very grateful to the many sociologists who are now studying this, is that they actually were more likely to be married than less likely to be married. More family stability, yeah, than those that they met in the North. And that's because they, in some ways, they had those old Southern church-going values where they had to work so hard that they had to cling together as clans, which is also very similar to the old country for almost anyone who comes to the United States. Then you get here and you get cityfied, and, well, who needs to have all those old strictures, and we're going to be like the urban people around us. It turned out that they were more likely to be raising their children in two-parent households, and they actually were making more money than the African-Americans that they found who were here already, the small core of people who were here, who were ministers, domestics, and others, because they had come from such a harsh place. They were willing, like most immigrants, to work longer hours because they had no choice, or to work multiple jobs. And so they actually made more money, even though they were making less per hour for their wages. And that's so typically, beautifully, classically American immigrant story. However, of course, they were not immigrants, and a lot of them don't view themselves as that, do not like the term, and don't even really view themselves as part of this great migration, which is one reason it wasn't written about as well or talked about. They did not talk about what they went through, and that's what made the work of uncovering this more challenging.
Well, you've got another oral history here, like Studs Terkel, and you've also managed to do what Howard Zinn did, you know, to create a kind of people's history at the same time. You also focus on three people.
Yes.
And I want to talk about those three people. You have essentially three migrants, one who came from Mississippi, a woman named Ida Mae Gladney, George Starling, who came from Florida, and Robert Foster, who came from Louisiana. Why these three?
I interviewed over 1,200 people to narrow it down to three protagonists who would together collectively represent the entire span and breadth and scope of this great migration.
I'm sorry, when I heard you use the word protagonist, I have to mention to listeners that you teach non-narrative fiction, narrative nonfiction. So you see this as kind of an unfolding epic novel.
Absolutely.
Ways, you know?
I view it as a true life novel in a way. I view it as a narrative, but it's based upon the 15 years of rigorous research that are required in order to make it come alive and to be the basis for the narrative. So the three individuals needed to represent the three major streams of this great migration. This was not a haphazard unfurling of lost souls. This was, as with any immigrant stream, an orderly relocation of people based upon railroad lines, bus routes, and where people knew someone already. And just as if you were to go to Minnesota and you'd find that many, many people there are from Sweden or Norway, you would also find that along the East Coast, the people in New York and in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia are often from Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia, which is the migration.
Right up the East Coast.
Right up the East Coast, which is, yeah, the migration stream from which my family was a part of. My mother came from Rome, Georgia to Washington, and my father from Southern Virginia in a different decade.
Could I say something about your,
yes,
pedigree? Because your father was a Tuskegee Airman.
My father was a Tuskegee Airman. And after the war, he, instead of returning to Virginia. He went to Washington, D.C., where he thought his prospects were better, met my mother, and here I am. And that's the story of so many African-Americans. Really, the majority of African-Americans that you meet in the North and the West are descended from people who were part of this great migration and might not even exist. It's hard to think. It's sort of this existential question you might have. What would have happened if they had not migrated and met? Because they would not have otherwise met. My mother in Georgia, my father in Virginia, they would never have met otherwise. So that's one stream, and I needed to make sure that that was represented by George Starling, who migrated from Florida to New York.
He was a kind of a, he stirred things up a bit, didn't he, down in Florida?
Yeah, he'd had some education, then he had to drop out because during those days, African-Americans could only go to a couple of schools which were far away. They could not go to the state schools. They could not go to the other private schools in Florida. So in his region of Florida, there were no other options when they felt they were not able to continue to send him. So he began returning to the work of the industry in his area, which was citrus industry, and he found that the conditions were unfair, they were dangerous, and they were being poorly paid, and he began trying to organize the fruit.
These are citrus growers. Yeah?
Citrus growers. Yeah, he tried to organize those citrus pickers and came under the scrutiny of the growers, the grove owners, who did not take well to their pickers demanding higher wages. And when we say higher wages, we're talking about a nickel more for a carton of citrus, which was going to ultimately go for $4 or $5 on the open market.
Well, the other two streams, just to
the other two streams.
Because I want to get you to California,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, of course. The other stream is up the Midwest, the Illinois Central, from Mississippi, Arkansas, parts of Illinois to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and the entire Midwest. And that stream is represented by the protagonist Ida Mae Gladney, who was a sharecropper's wife, who was terrible at picking cotton. Awful at picking it. She could kill a snake, and she could wring the neck of a chicken to cook it for dinner, but she could not pick cotton very well. She and her husband ended up having to leave, and their two children ended up having to leave flee essentially without telling anyone.
After, they saw a beating, right?
After a cousin was beaten nearly to death for a crime he did not commit. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day, but he was beaten within an inch of his life. And after that happened, her husband said to her, "This is the last crop we're making." So she represents the Midwest stream.
Went to Chicago. It's like heaven, at least for a while.
Yeah, she said it was like heaven when she first saw it. And then finally, the stream that has gotten the least attention from historians, and that is the stream that brought people from Louisiana and Texas out to the West Coast, from San Diego up to Seattle. And that is represented by a physician, a surgeon, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who
was Ray Charles' personal
who
physician.
He became Ray Charles' personal physician. I mean, as the story unfolds, you learn that it took a long time and a lot of hard work before he could get to the point where Ray Charles was one of his patients. But he had been a surgeon in the Army, and he was able to practice medicine in the Army. But when he got out of the Army after the Korean War, it turned out he could not practice medicine in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And so he set out on a course for California. He knew he wanted to be in California because that is where many of the people who had left Monroe had come. And there's some really famous people who were part of that migration stream from that small town.
Of Monroe, Louisiana.
Louisiana. One was Huey Newton, founder of the Black Panthers.
He wound up in Oakland.
And in a whole different sphere of life, Bill Russell. Bill Russell, the great defensive player,
one of the best basketball players of all time.
Yeah. His parents had a very difficult time in Monroe, Louisiana. One story that very quickly about his situation was his father was once at a gas station in Monroe, Louisiana, in line to get gas. But as was the custom, any white customer who would come up for anything, whether it was for ice cream or for gas, would go first. And he had to wait, and he waited, and he waited. And eventually, because he was in a hurry, he decided he would back out of the gas station and go to another one. The owner of the gas station stopped pumping for the white person he was helping and went over to Bill Russell's father, put a gun to his head, and said, "You leave when I tell you you can leave." once Bill Russell saw his mother crying at the kitchen table over the straits they were in, and they decided to come out west, a treacherous journey. It took a lot of resources and a lot of grit and determination to make it this far, because this is the farthest you might possibly go if you were African-American in the South, or any race for that matter. So they had to be particularly determined. They came to Oakland, and it was here that in the Bay Area that he had the opportunity to go to better schools. He would never have been able to go to integrated schools as he did here. He would not have had the opportunity to go to college in this an integrated college. He went to the University of San Francisco, where he led the Dons to two NCAA championships. That would never have happened had his parents stayed in Monroe, Louisiana. And then, of course, he was recruited to the Celtics and led them to 11 championships out of 13 years, and history was made.
Of course, some of these stories in the North aren't that pretty either. There's a George Sterling story that you tell about he wouldn't have been served a highball in the South, but then he's in the North and somebody serves him the drink, but then smashes the glass afterward because he's so angry for having had to serve a black man. There also, you know, San Francisco was a huge magnet, of course, as you point out, and the shipyards were here.
The shipyards.
And so many after the war came here. I mean, it was part of this migration. It changed the whole face, obviously, of
absolutely.
San Francisco.
Absolutely. And one reason why the West Coast migration has not gotten the same attention is because it was a later migration than the others. The earlier migrations were World War I. This was World War II. By that time, it was so well established in other parts of the country that it got much more attention. So it was my pleasure and honor to be able to spend time here. I spent a lot of time in many of the senior centers here, talking with many of the people who knew Robert Foster, because he came here to Oakland as well in search of what would be the best place for him. And he ultimately settled in Los Angeles, but there are little footprints for him here too, because of Monroe, Louisiana.
Well, you have spent a good deal of time in Chicago, and I was struck by a portrait of a family named the Clark family who came up from Mississippi. For many reasons, but particularly because I remember Martin Luther King marching through Chicago and saying that in Cicero he had never seen hatred anywhere, including the Deep South, like he saw in Cicero. And this family, in some ways,
It was he had served the country in the World War II. The family looked like they could be in, and at that point, Life magazine or Look magazine of the era. They were, they looked like they could be in cereal commercials. Just a lovely family, and they were hemmed in, and they were actually living in sharing a 2-room apartment with another family. So they were like 8 people or 12 or so in one living situation. They wanted to get out. He had what was considered a pretty good job at that time as a bus driver. So they settled on an apartment that they found and were so excited about. They would actually be paying less money for more room in a suburb near his job in the town of Cicero. Cicero was filled with recent immigrants from Lithuania, Czechoslovakia, from Italy, from Russia. And when they tried to move into this apartment, they met with such tremendous resistance that they were not even permitted to actually go in themselves. They managed to get their belongings in. So they got their piano, their sofa, their chairs and that sort of thing, their baby pictures and wedding pictures and all that. But they couldn't stay that night. And what happened was they ended up, the night after they had moved in, the people began to gather around and they took over the whole...
They took all
their belongings. Yeah. Hurled them out the window and set them afire.
Yeah, this is the promised land, unfortunately, the tragic side of it. Let me put the phone number here. If you would care to join us with Isabel Wilkerson, you're welcome to do so. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. I know there are many of you, especially African-Americans, who have some stories of your own. Feel free to join us. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786 for your questions and comments. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. It's a new history of the migration which brought millions of black Southerners up north and into the Midwest and here in the West as well. And she'll be appearing in Oakland this evening at St. Paul's Episcopal at 7:30. And Judy Campbell, our producer who lives in Oakland, reminds me of the fact that there was a big food and canning industry in Oakland that brought a lot of Americans post-war from the Black South. And that migration is really the focus, that is the whole migration of all those different regions of Isabel Wilkerson's book. It was a rite of passage for many blacks, of course, and for black families establishing themselves, but it really changed America. You were also indicating that you had to really understand the geology of the South, because I was saying that I never saw the South referred to as bottomland before, and I'm sure you're familiar with Toni Morrison's Sula, where she talks about the bottom being actually a segment of black life, clearly trying to show that this region had its own identity, like the South had for blacks. It was home. It was like Mother Africa had been for the slaves who came here, for those who wound up in the North. I mean, there is that analogy, isn't there?
There is that analogy. In fact, that was one of the goals or one of the subtexts of the book as I was approaching it. And that is that for African Americans, obviously, everyone knows that the ultimate origin for African Americans was the continent of Africa, particularly the western part of Africa. But for our identity now, for African American identity now, and for the great interest that people have in genealogy of all races and ethnicities, most African Americans in the North and the West must return to the South in order to understand where they came from. And that takes you right back to the Great Migration. How did the people get here? Why did they get here? And so it means that the ancestral homeland for African Americans culturally and psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually is the South. And coming to terms with that is sometimes difficult, which is one reason why it was sometimes difficult to actually tell this story, because a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. People didn't, the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents often didn't pass the stories down, because when they left the South, they left it for good and they didn't look back. Some people changed their name. Dr. Foster, who we refer to, the protagonist who came from Monroe, Louisiana to California, actually changed his name on the drive out. He decided, I'm going to be no longer as Pershing, but as Robert.
And Pershing was a good American name, you know, General Pershing.
Well, that's what his mother named him for, but he decided he was going to be different, and he was going to change it to Robert. Or Robert was his first name, actually.
You wanted to hear the myriad of voices in this. It's pretty clear. I mean, again, you mentioned Sandberg. There's a sense in Sandberg and of the American vernacular. You wanted to capture that oral history through the voices themselves, didn't you?
That was what I felt was most missing in any discussion of the Great Migration, because it was first examined by economists and sociologists in World War I. They were looking at what was the effect of all this in the North and South. They were looking at what was the impact of all these people being crowded together, one on top of the other, the health issues related to that. And so it was usually looked at as a problem arriving in the cities. It wasn't looked at from the individual heart's desire of the people who were making this move. And that's sort of what got lost in the translation as it took on the role of something that was affecting and in some ways, in their view, hurting the cities. And I wanted to go back and find out, in the same way that there...
Well, it's the difference between, I was just thinking, Rudolf Fischer, who's a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance, said, too much about the Negro problem. I want to find out who these people are.
Who are
I want
the
their
people?
Humanity, and I want readers to find out who they are. Yeah.
Exactly, and that was what was being lost in this. And I approached the book with a great sense of urgency, because the migration began in 1915 and ended in 1970. You're talking multiple generations of people who made this migration, and they were getting up in years, and time was running out. So I went about this with a great sense of urgency, in the same way that people in the 30s were trying to get to the former slaves, because before it was too late to hear those stories.
Capture that soul soon gone, as Jean Toomer put it.
Yes.
I'm thinking about that poem of Toomer's in my introduction, Who Set You Flowing, because he's talking about Washington, where you come from, and the ballooning and the Cadillacs and money in the pocket and all that sort of thing, but asking the question of what set it off. And it's, you know, when you think about the thousands and thousands of people who came here, as I said, it's almost a microcosm of America, of the American experience.
It is.
Looking for a new life, looking sometimes for streets of gold in the North, just like immigrants from Europe were looking for streets of gold in America. Really, you've really made those connections. We're going to make connections with our listeners. And in fact, if you'd like to join us with Isabel Wilkerson, you're welcome to do that. Our toll-free number is available. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, it's 866-733-6786. Or you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org. And here are some emails. Diane writes, let's not forget Memphis. My husband, Clarence W. Smith, was the 12th black in the San Francisco Police Department. He came to San Francisco from Memphis, lived in Hunters Point with six other men, and worked in the shipyards for several years before moving up to Muni Driver, then to the SFPD. His compatriots in that apartment were all from Memphis. More from one of the two black high schools in Memphis. Most of those men from Memphis stayed in California, married and raised families. Some served in the armed forces during the Second World War, but some, like my husband, sought higher education, got stuck, and came to the land of plenty. Most of my husband's friends are now deceased, but they had quite some stories to tell of life in Memphis and why they could never go back. Here's another listener, Russell from Oakland. How can urban black communities recover the kind of values around education, entrepreneurship, and ownership that the earlier generations of immigrants brought with them? Boy, what a question, huh?
That's a great question.
I mean, if we had the answers, we'd be out there stumping as politicians or maybe giving sermons on Sunday. Drew from Berkeley says, I'm interested in hearing the impact of World War II on the migration of the jobs and the shipyards in the West. And, well, you touched on that to some extent, but it was almost kind of, in some ways, word of mouth. It was like the old follow the drinking gourd, you know, to go up to the north through the Underground Railroad. The jobs are there, and it became kind of like a meme would be today or a viral thing.
Well, I call it the Overground Railroad.
Yeah, that's good. Because it was. You know, there are jobs up north. Head up north. For Horace Greeley said, go west, young man. And blacks were telling each other, go north.
Well, you remember that there is always this deep desire, this latent urge to get out. All it needed was a precipitating event, just the hope, the thin thread, there was a chance to make it out, that there was something for them. Because if you think about it, after the Emancipation Proclamation, why was there no flood of people coming out after slavery? During the years from 1865 until World War One, why weren't there a flood of people leaving the South when they would have had every reason, one would think, particularly as Jim Crow began to become the law of the land, tightening the vise on what people could and could not do when they were in the South.
I think somebody like Arne Bontom makes that apparent in, I don't know if you know his novel Black Thunder, but he writes about how a lot of the post-slavery blacks really thought that they were going to get a freedom. That freedom almost signified to them with the Emancipation Proclamation that they would have land, they would have the kinds of things that they were in their own minds being promised that came to represent the whole ideal of freedom. And it just didn't come.
You're absolutely right. In fact, this...
That's Bontom, not me.
Yeah, the generation of people who started this great migration, the first ones to leave, were the grandchildren of those people. They could see that the Emancipation Proclamation had not come true for them, that actually life had become much harder because Jim Crow laws began to tighten the vise on African Americans as opposed to loosening them and giving them the freedoms that they had hoped and had been promised. And so these were the people, the children, who had no more patience for what was going on. And when the North began recruiting African Americans because of the shutdown of immigration to the North because of the European War, World War One, they responded because finally there was an option that they hadn't had before. And they were primed and ready to leave because they could see that the Emancipation Proclamation had not lived up to its name. And in some ways, they made it come true through their decision to leave.
There's a lot of anger and indignation, too, about returning soldiers. Many of these black soldiers came back and they'd fought for their country. And again, the freedom and the rights weren't there because of white supremacy.
Yeah, there was a case of a soldier who returned to Georgia, and he was ordered to take his uniform off to never be seen in it again. He wore it again in any case, and he was killed for it.
Let me go to our callers, and we'll begin with TJ from Mountain View. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Excellent. Good. New cell phone. A quick observation and then actually a question, too, having listened to the program so far. I grew up in Chicago on the South Side and worked in the savings and loan after school, and one of the women there was an older woman, black woman, from the South originally, Mississippi, and her story of her migration was taking the bus, standing the entire time because it was so packed with people, all the way from, I'm not sure where in Mississippi, up to Chicago, exactly for the economic opportunity that was going on at that time. So I just wanted to share that and mention also a think it's Maya Angelou in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing, mentions coming out to San Francisco and settling in the Fillmore District because it was empty from all the Japanese who had been interned, and noting sort of her ambivalence about that in the story there. But my question is, I recall that there's a book called 100 Years of Lynching in America, which covers from about 1857 to 1957 and has a number of stories about people being killed in the South for owning land, having economic success, and just property taken from them. It's published in the paper. I'm wondering what's the sort of connection perhaps with Booker T. Washington or George Washington Carver's philosophy of the African-American will have success in this country by setting out on their own for business. And wasn't that really sort of going on in the early 20th century? And is that perhaps the motivation for this? And thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Those are great questions, and he's actually touching on several things. One is I wanted to say that I'm familiar with the book, The 100 Years of Lynching. In fact, I had a period of time in working on this book in which I read a book a day, and I had a period where I was reading about cotton production. I had a period where I was trying to understand the geology of the South, the politics of the South, how Jim Crow, the different ways that Jim Crow manifested itself. And I had a period in which I was reading about lynchings. And during that time, I was not very popular at dinner parties because people would say, well, what did you, you know, how did your day go? And no one wanted to hear what I was talking about because it was so unpleasant. There was absolutely a connection between, the violence that they had to endure. There's actually a preeminent historian, white historian of the South at that time, who observed that to be African American in the South for many of the decades of the 20th century, and again, we're not talking 19th century slavery, we're talking about the lifetime, some things that occurred during the lifetime of many people who are still alive today, that for the average African American, they would have known someone who was lynched or would certainly have known of a lynching near them. But that violence was as real as the cotton growing in the fields. It was just a part of life, a fact of life for them.
So for many, the North was a refuge of safety, or at least maybe the illusion of safety. But
absolutely.
Safety, yeah.
There are many things that would happen to them and did happen to them in the North. We mentioned Harvey Clark and his family, that they lost their belongings. I mean, the people threw out all of their things. They even wrenched out the radiators from the wall. They were just so, it was sort of a mob mentality that had gotten out of control. They threw the things out and then they burned all their belongings, the piano, the baby pictures, the wedding pictures and all that. And then they proceeded to burn down the building. And that left the white people living in the building.
This is like 1951.
This was 1951, yeah. In a suburb of Chicago, not that long ago, historically speaking. And yet, they lost their belongings, but they didn't lose their life. And had they been in the South, that even the idea of moving, the thought of moving to a place like that would have been incomprehensible.
Although they didn't lynch women and children for the most part, they were almost all men.
Almost
who were lynched,
all.
Yeah.
There were some women, but for the most part, you're absolutely right. It was mostly men. And there was a time period where there was a lynching every 3 or 4 days in the South. And that was just a fact of life. So the caller makes a really good point about the connection there.
There's also the caller bringing up Booker T. Washington reminds me of the fact that there was a serious, and some would say ongoing, ideological split between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois in the sense of what black people should be doing for their people and how they should be moving economically up or socially up the ladder.
Well, I think one of the fascinating things about the Great Migration, as with any immigration, is that it was leaderless. There was no one who said, on this day we will, or this month we will all leave the South, or the day to leave is this. The Chicago Defender tried to do that, and they were trying to encourage people more to come up. But for the most part, Booker T. Washington was vehemently against the migration. Frederick Douglass vehemently was against the migration. In fact, he said that leaving the land of the ancestors that had been built by the hands of people who worked for free would be a disheartening surrender. So they were very much against it. And
what about Du Bois? Do we know where he stood?
Du Bois was always much more progressive, but he was already in the North, so people in the North were more likely to be in favor of people getting out. So he was actually quite militant about the idea of freedom in all its forms.
Because he was turning Pan-African, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was a totally different form of thought. But even the local leadership, people were not listening to their leaders. They were not listening to the ministers. Some of the ministers had to follow their flock north because the people had gone. And one story is of a minister who was in Tampa, Florida. He announced from the pulpit one Sunday that there's all this ferment. People were talking that they wanted to leave. Everyone was talking about that they wanted to leave. How might they do it? Where would they go? And he said, we should not do that. We should stay here in the South. I am encouraging all of you to stay here. This is where where we help build this land. We should stay here. The next day he was stabbed for saying that. The church people.
Wow. Whew, okay. Let me get some more callers on here. Rita, hi. Join us. You're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I've been so impressed with your book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. I was wondering if you have viewed the work of the artist Kara Walker, and if you have, how that has been, how it impresses you.
I am familiar with her work, and I think that the work is beautiful. I spent most of my time in the research of this book immersed in the world and the work of the people of that era. For example, I did a lot of reading, clearly, of Richard Wright, and I'm very, very much moved by the work of Jacob Lawrence, who was in some ways the seminal artist who represented the Migration series, which was very, very popular. Everyone has probably seen it, even if they don't recognize it, where he would describe in tableau the despair of sitting at the kitchen table and these brilliant Crayola colors that he would use in his representations of the Great Migration.
That's also thinking Aaron Douglas did some work on migration, too.
Exactly. Yeah. To tell you the truth,
But Kara Walker is our generation. She's only, 30. She's been a MacArthur Fellow.
Yes.
And she takes just little sentences out of the history of the written record and does little moving sort of animation that reenacts with puppets these things that have happened, and I think her art is some of the strongest art that we can see today.
Yeah, no, I admire her work. I'm just saying that in the course of the reporting for the book, I ended up focusing on the era because I wanted to bring it to life based upon the people who were speaking at that time, because I feel that the current generation has much opportunity to share their stories now, and I think it's wonderful that people are embracing this and looking back. So I admire it and cheer her on.
And thank you for the call, Rita. We'll go to more calls in a moment, but how has the relationship with the South changed for Black Americans?
Well,
from all this,
one of the legacies of the Great Migration is that the South did ultimately change. It ultimately changed. I mean, with a fitful change at the Civil Rights Movement, but ultimately it did acquiesce. And it wasn't until the 70s that actually many of the laws that were passed, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and of 68, they did not actually take hold in the South until the 70s. And then after that, the very reasons for leaving in many cases no longer existed. The essential persecution aspect of the departure was no longer there. And so a reverse migration of not necessarily the people who originally left, a lot of them left for good and didn't look back, but of their children and grandchildren. Has been going on since the migration ended.
Well, I was thinking about you living in Boston, and I'm old enough to remember when Boston was having terrible problems with school segregation. There were those in the South, places like Georgia, writing and saying, come down here and you can see how we've integrated our schools since you can't seem to be able to do it.
Exactly.
Let me get some more callers in here, and we'll go to Santa Rosa. Rick, hi, you're on.
My question is, has anyone analyze the economics of the Great Migration, because it seems to me that it terribly impoverished the South economically and enriched the North economically, because the people who left were enormously creative and enormously energetic, and the South has lost them. I don't think it's ever recovered from that loss.
I think that you make a really good point. The South to this day lags the North and the West when it comes to wages, when it comes to measures of health. obesity, when it comes to educational achievement, when it comes to housing and property values, when it comes to the proliferation of Fortune 500 companies. The South is still paying a price for essentially centuries of a feudal system that was not working, and the ultimate loss of its cheap labor, and in some ways, as we've said before, in some cases, the most ambitious and better educated people in that workforce, the people who are least likely to accept the status quo. And so there's a tremendous loss. I don't know that anyone has actually looked at it in the totality. I mean, the focus of this book is to help the reader see what it was like to be in the circumstances of the people who migrated, and to get a sense of the enormity of it through the lives of individuals, to make it real and make it come alive for the reader. And the reviews seem to be suggesting that people are enjoying it, and that's the goal of this particular book. Maybe that's something that I can do.
Well, I also think it's a great book for young people, and I don't only mean black kids. I mean, you know, kids growing up to realize just how significant these stories are, because like you say, they're such American stories. Reminded again of Richard Wright saying, "The Negro is America's metaphor." Talk about the title, by the way. It is from Wright.
Yeah, the title is The Warmth of Other Suns, and it comes from a passage that I was so proud to be able to excavate, because it comes from page 496 of the annotated version of his biography. Now, that sounds very complicated. He had a biography that he wrote in the 1940s, and the annotated version has additional material that's not available in the final one. And I was
delighted. Autobiography, right?
Autobiography, yeah, correct. So. Autobiography. His own story of his migration from Natchez, Mississippi to Chicago via Memphis. And in it, I discovered this passage that just blew me away. The book was a nameless child, an orphan child without a name for much of the time I was working on it. And as soon as I saw this passage, then I knew that was what the title should be.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let's go to another caller here. And Mark, that's you. Hi, welcome. You're on.
Hi. I really want to thank you for this interview this morning and for the work you've been doing. This book brought up a sweet memory of my mom. She was from a long line of people who identified as being Ohioans. Five generations, and she talked about seeing when she was probably around 12, seeing new people come into town and running home to tell her mother there's a new colored family in town. And it's striking to me hearing this, because she probably saw my dad. He migrated, his family migrated, and some years later they were married. So I just really appreciated your bringing up that memory.
I appreciate your vocalizing it. Thank you so much for the call, Mark. Good to hear from you this morning. I think it's also important for younger people, especially, to understand and grasp just what living Jim Crow was like and what drove so many of these people up here. When you're talking about Wright, I was reminded about his writing about the ethic of living Jim Crow, and talking about how he went in Natchez to a library because he was interested in reading Mencken, and mm-hmm. Mencken was not allowed. You know, Mencken was get uppity if you read Mencken. And he went and he wrote a note to the librarian saying, "Give this," with the N-word, "boy some Mencken because I want to read Mencken." And the librarian couldn't possibly think that he had written the note, because he had done this under subterfuge. But there was also the story that began that ethic of living Jim Crow. Some white kids were throwing things at him, cinder blocks or whatever, pieces of cinder blocks, and he was throwing them back. And his parents beat the hell out of him. They said, "You don't throw things back, because you'll stir up the white people and they'll wind up, you know, burning our house down or doing terrible things to us."
Yeah, the codes of living under Jim Crow were so strict that the parents lived in fear that their children, who, if they did not inculcate in them what that caste system was, they could be in great danger. And you think about being a parent at that time where you want your child to be able to grow free and not, really they couldn't truly understand this political, economic, social, and cultural system that they were growing up in. And it was extremely difficult for them to tell children, no, you can't go and swing in the swing like those other children are. They didn't want them to not have self-esteem, but at the same time, they didn't want them to be endangered. So it was always difficult. And there are several references in the that I discovered, several examples where a child might have acted out as a normal child would when someone comes up and spits on you, for example. And the parents said, you cannot fight back like that. And the child would ask, well, why can't I? You just can't. And one child in Mississippi, Grenada, Mississippi, his father, when this occurred, his father didn't talk with him the whole time home. He was so upset and angry. He actually, when a little white boy had come up to his son and spit on him, the father apologized to the little white boy for his son having he bumped him accidentally because he was reading a comic book. And so there was this great fear. The father went home and told his mother, I don't know what we're going to do about Gilbert. He's not going to last here in the South. And Gilbert ultimately left for Ohio when he got old enough to leave.
We're coming to the end of the program here, alas. I would have liked to have heard you read from the epilogue. Can you tell us a little bit about that epilogue?
Would you like me to read it?
We've got like only a minute and a half. I don't know if we have time,
it's
really.
It's not that long.
Yeah, let's try.
All right. I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
There it is from Richard Wright. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, she'll be at the St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Oakland this evening at 7:30. The book, again, is The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. Professor of Journalism and Director of Narrative Nonfiction at Boston University, Isabel Wilkerson, our guest this hour. We thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and we remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at number 415-553-3300. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amy Machado. Our interns are Nadia Reed, Elena Cadavani, and Aiden Stone, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.